You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you all are well today and you had a very good Veterans Day weekend. My name is John Allen and I'm the president of the Brookings Institution. And it's great to be with all of you who have gathered here today for this event, and all of you who are tuning in via webcast. This past weekend marked the centenary of the conclusion of World War I. As the historians in the audience will recall, it was the Armistice Agreement of 1918 that would cause the guns of the Western Front to fall silent on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of that year, thus Armistice Day. And from 1954 onward in the United States, it would be known as Veterans Day. For all its participants, the casualties and the suffering of World War I vastly exceeded that of any previous war. And for the European participants, it would be the war to end all wars, and they marked what would become known as the Lost Generation, in recognition of the millions of young men who died in the trenches of World War I. As horrendous as the war had been for all the warring parties, America's entry into the war in 1917 largely decided the outcome and saved the Allied effort. Even so, the U.S. would suffer over 50,000 combat deaths and over 100,000 total of their deaths on the Western Front. And this war would last barely a year for the United States. Nevertheless, America's appearance in the war catapulted it to the world stage for the first time in its history, as it stepped forward as a political, economic, and military leader of a nascent world order. Yet soon after, the United States largely disengaged from that same international order that it helped to build, becoming sadly isolationist, protectionist, and xenophobic, with devastating consequences over the next two decades, leading directly into World War II. To both mark the centennial remembrance of Armistice Day, as well as discuss how the decisions and the events of those days unfolded, and the subsequent impact that they've had on history, we've gathered three top experts on international order for a conversation on the role of the United States in the world, both then and now, in the aftermath of World War I. For that discussion, I'll be welcoming Bob Kagan, our senior fellow here at Brookings, and author of the excellent book, The Jungle Grows Back, America and Our Imperiled World. As well, our guest today is Adam Tooze, the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Professor of History at Columbia University. Dr. Tooze is also the author of two recent, highly relevant books for today's discussion, The Deluge, The Great War, America and the Remaking of the Global Order, 1916 to 1931, and Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. Dr. Tooze, Adam, it's great to have you with us this morning. Thank you for joining us. And finally, we'll be welcoming the man moderating today's event, Brookings Senior Fellow and Director of our Center for the United States and Europe, Tom Wright. And after roughly an hour of discussion, they'll turn out to you, the audience, for questions and answers. And a final reminder that we are live and we're on the record for today's session. Let me close just a moment with two simple requests, though, as we reflect on the most recent Veterans Day. And I would ask that each of us make a point of both thanking a veteran for his or her sacrifices while on active duty, or for those who remain on active duty to thank them for their service. And second, remember that all veterans, all the veterans who came before us, sacrificed for us so that we could gather today to have this conversation. And though we've moved past the day itself, with the inevitable march of time, we should recognize that many of our veterans are leaving us in large numbers, even as we speak today. And it's never a bad moment to show your appreciation for these precious individuals who gave so much for the freedoms that we enjoy today in America and around the world. So with that, let me welcome to the stage Brookings Senior Fellows Bob Kagan and Tom Wright, and our visiting scholar today, Professor Adam Tooze, for today's discussion. Thank you very much, and welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, John, and thank you all to you in the audience for coming and for all of you joining us on webcast. So I'm delighted to moderate this panel discussion today with Adam and Bob on the topic of the World War One, our myths to stay, what it means for today, but also what followed World War One, that 20-year period that led to the collapse of world order and World War II, and the role of American leadership. And both Adam and Bob have written really fascinating books on this topic. And so we'd like to look at those lessons, but also take it to today, what it means for the role of Europe today, for American leadership, for U.S., China. But I think it would only be appropriate really to start with the history. And so, Bob, if I could maybe start with you and just ask, what do you think the main lesson is of the interwar period and what followed World War One for world politics today? What's the big sort of takeaway from your scholarship and work on that and geopolitics?
Well, thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to be on a panel with Adam Tooze, for whom I have enormous admiration. His new book is Crashed, which is a big, making a big sensation, but I strongly recommend that you go back and read his book, The Deluge, or is it just Deluge?
I don't remember.
Anyway, which is, it covers an interesting period, 1916 to 1931. I always wanted to ask you how you picked those exact dates, but I guess it's probably clear from the book, which is a terrific book, and you should go back and read it. I mean, when I was listening to John talk about Armistice Day and the return and the sort of the end of the war, you know, Americans had a very mixed reaction to a war that they had played a part in winning. Obviously, the war was won by French and British troops. The Americans came very late, even though we entered the war technically in April of 1917. We didn't get any substantial forces to anything like the front until the summer of 1918. And by that time, the war ended in November. And this actually had an unfortunate effect in terms of American attitudes, which is the soldiers then hung around in Europe for months waiting to be shipped back home. And in that time, they were sort of bivouacked in French and German homes, and they found out that they didn't like the French and they did like the Germans for some reason. And so when they came back, they were not, actually, there was no great feeling about their experience. Most of them hadn't gone into the fight. They'd spent a long time training. And there was very little in the way of celebration, actually, because there had just been a political election, midterms. Neither the president nor his opposition wanted to give the other side any credit for anything that had happened. So, and then Wilson immediately headed off to Europe to negotiate, and so he never took a victory lap. And all this contributed to a tremendous sort of disillusionment, which was then heavily compounded and used in what was a bloody partisan, you know, metaphorically bloody partisan struggle that began immediately. I know this is shocking to you to think that politicians would use foreign policy or any other tool in order for purely partisan purposes.
Even without Twitter.
Pardon?
Even without Twitter.
Even without Twitter, yes. And so, and everybody was thinking immediately, as happens after a midterm election, what happens after a midterm election? What's the next subject? The next subject is the next presidential election, And for the Republicans, everything was about winning the next presidential election. And the leader of Republican, the leading Republican in the country was Henry Cabot Lodge, who had become the Senate Majority Leader, Chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and his number one goal was to get a Republican back in the White House after the Democrats had been in the White House for 8 years under Wilson, which was a tremendous aberration since the Civil War and unthinkable. And he used the treaty fight as a way of doing that. It was essential that that Wilson's treaty and League of Nations had to be defeated, otherwise it would help the Democrats in 2020, and which led in turn to a tremendous sort of insistence that everything that Wilson was trying to do and everything that was happening in Europe was a failure. That is a prelude, because I think it's important to understand the political background to this, that Americans then were terribly disillusioned and negative about the war. They defeated the treaty, and this had a huge impact in Europe. And the impact was inevitable, because what the United States had done in entering the war was completely shift the balance of forces in Europe to what from what had been at most a stalemate and possibly a stalemate favoring Germany to a situation where Germany now was completely overwhelmed by essentially American economic and ultimately American demographic power, added to that of France and France and Britain. And so the American role in the war completely changed the balance. But when America then decided that it was not going to participate anymore, the balance that had been created and the balance upon which the Versailles Treaty was premised was then removed. The Americans were pulled out of the equation. Now you had, once again, an unstable balance on the continent, and a treaty that reflected one balance now had to be carried out in a different balance. And so the withdrawal of the United States, essentially, and we could talk about all the economic and the military aspects of that, but the bottom line was the Versailles Treaty, which is so discredited by so many historians, was never meant to work without the United States. And with the United States, I actually think there was a chance of achieving a stable peace in Europe. Without the United States, there was effectively no chance. And so, you know, in our this, we always think about what happened after World War II and the United States playing this critical role. The United States had the opportunity to play that critical role after 1918 and chose not to, and I think it falls heavily on the United States, the disaster that then unfolded over the next 20 years.
So, Adam, you're in the Deluge, you're, I think, take a sort of a similar line in terms of the role of the U.S. after World War One, but you're very critical of President Wilson rather than of the domestic sort of political situation. And as I understand it, your argument is that the U.S. had this immense power, this sort of looming potential from 1916 on, and that the U.S. basically failed to take sort of a constructive role in terms of working with Britain and France to construct this order. Do you sort of see things sort of similarly to Bob in terms of, and also address the, if you have a totally different sort of lesson from that period as well, please talk about that. But I'm just interested also in trying to tease out some of the differences maybe on where the blame lies in the 20s for that abdication of U.S. leadership.
Yeah, no, I mean, 19, thank you very much. And it's an absolute delight to be here. Brookings is a legend, and it's delightful to be on a platform with the famous blue backdrop. And to be alongside Bob and Tom is really a delight. So very, very happy to be here, and on this occasion in particular, of course. I was thinking about World War One because I wrote a book about Nazi Germany, and thinking about Nazi Germany led me back to the war. And the argument of the book about Nazi Germany was that the United States was pivotal to driving Hitler's aggression, in the sense that the United States was the looming force in global politics from the 1930s onwards already. The economic power of the United States, even in a situation of depression, with the promise of Fordist mass production transforming the material circumstances of everyone's lives, is deeply saturating European and Asian political and social culture at this moment. All of this was in the background. So, as it were, the shadow of American power hangs over Europe. And my read was that National Socialism, was not Hitler's movement and its aggression was a reaction to that threat. Of course, in his case, suffused with anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, which have attached themselves to American power for longer than one might credit. This is a long-standing idea that American power reflects the influence of the world Jewish conspiracy. And in the book I wrote about World War I, what I wanted to do was write the prequel to that and to understand whether it was really true that that politics more generally across the world, power politics, had come to revolve around the United States. And I do think that 1916 is an extraordinary moment in that respect, because it's obviously an American presidential year. And for the first time in history, the attention of the world was focused on the outcome of an American presidential election. This is so, for the century and more that has followed, we take this for granted. I was saying to Bob earlier today that in Berlin, 10 days ago, there were two conceptions of the world, Plan A and Plan B, and it hinged on the outcome of the American midterms. That's literally the basic structure in question for German foreign policy. And after the American midterms, they probably still don't know what world they're in. That reality of everyone's decisions being conditioned on the outcome of American democratic processes stems to 1916. If you think about the mass of historical literature that we have on the outbreak of World War I in 1914 in the July crisis, America features nowhere. However long the book, and it could be 1,500, 2,000 pages, America, the diplomacy of William Jennings Bryan, the Secretary of State, is an irrelevance to 1914. It wasn't until the 1890s that the British became the first European power to actually install a full embassy on Embassy Row in Washington, D.C. Up to that point, America was such a peripheral irrelevance to global affairs that you could do with a consulate. So quite suddenly, the world reorientates around the United States. And I do think it does so quite spectacularly, whether you look at decision-making in Imperial Japan or the insurgent nationalists in China, or the French Republicans trying to figure out whether they can make the French Republic survive, or the British Empire trying to figure out what future it will have in the 20th century, or indeed in Germany. Everyone's decision-making in the final phases of World War I is conditioned by some idea about how they're going to relate to the United States. And we shouldn't be too pessimistic, I think, about the outcome of the war and the way in which it ended. Particularly, we shouldn't fall into the trap of contrasting it negatively with the end of World War II, which many people think of as being the war where we learned the lessons and we should be cooperative with each other, and out of them came European integration, and then contrast that darkly with what happened in 1918. That's about as much the inverse of reality as we can possibly imagine. The extraordinary thing about 1918, in a sense, is that it was ended through negotiation. This is a total war with tens of thousands of men dying every week in the major battlefields. And yet the European states and the United States found it within themselves, even as the shooting was going on. In those final battles of 1918, as our chair was saying, those 50,000 Americans, they died in a space of two to three months. Even as killing on that scale is going on, like entire Iraq war campaigns compressed into a single week, the politicians and diplomats are finding it within themselves to negotiate. And what enables that is Woodrow Wilson. And it's hugely controversial at the time. Woodrow Wilson starts unilateral, it's not Twitter, but it's telegraph diplomacy with Berlin in the first week of October, just as the American army is going into intense fighting in northern France. And the reaction of the insurgent and the resurgent Republicans who are going to win those midterms in the first week of November is to impeach Wilson for betraying the American soldier who's fighting in the field, and without the cooperation of the British and the French, without communicating with them, the American soldiers are fighting alongside British and French troops with British and French equipment. This isn't World War II. American soldiers in World War I fight with French equipment, not the other way around. Over the heads of London and Paris, Wilson is negotiating on his peace terms with Germany. And it's out of that process that we get to the armistice of the 11th of November. Contrast with 1945 at Torgau, where the war ends when there is literally no living German, no living German between the advancing Red Army and the American GIs. So messy is the battlefield on which they meet that it takes them 3 days to clean it up satisfactorily for Time magazine and Time Life magazine to be able to take photos. Because what the retreated German army had done is blown up a bridge, including women and children in a convoy, and the scene was that of mangled civilian devastation where the Russians and the Americans met in 1945. In 1918, it's a emerging German democracy which negotiates this peace. That, the result of the subsequent peace negotiations, should be disappointing, I think, is the last thing that should surprise us. It's evident that it will be disappointing, because that kind of negotiated peace out of the maelstrom, the horror of a war consuming tens of thousands of lives every single week, has to be based to some degree on illusions. You have to be kidding yourselves about what you're going to get out of this. Otherwise, you never get to that moment of actually ending the fighting. You simply need that element of illusion, compounded by the fact, and this is to exculpate the Americans, if you like, that the expectations of every single power in the world are focused on America, and they're not compatible with each other. Some people are going to end up devastatingly disappointed by the conclusion. The Americans managed to disappoint everybody, which does take a certain amount of failure on the American part. But that this should be a disappointing conclusion should not distract us from the fact that the war ended, and the war ended without the total annihilation of Germany. And that, I think, would be the next point that I would make in defense of 1918, is that the peace itself is not the act of savagery that it's sometimes made out to be, and certainly not the act of savagery that the reality of peacemaking after 1945 was. The way in which the difficult ethno-political landscape of Eastern Europe after 1945 is resolved is by means of the ethnic cleansing of 13 million Germans. 13 million Germans. This is larger than the Pakistani-India transfer. It is at least as murderous. 13 million Germans are earthed after 1945 so as to create the ethnically homogenous states of Poland and Czechoslovakia that will become the foundations of a peaceful order in the Cold War period under Soviet hegemony. None of that kind of violence is contemplated in 1918. The fundamental sovereignty of Germany, to the agony of Germany's politicians who have to exercise it, remains intact. Infringed, of course, hemmed in, subject to conditions, but the ultimate agony for the Germans in June 1919 is they have to sign this peace. No one expected Konrad Adenauer to sign the peace that ended World War II. There was no peace that Germany could sign. He was an installed government in the Western zone after all of the dirty work had been done. In 1919, the German politicians are asked to sign their own evisceration as a state. Yes, absolutely. This would have been a much more stable structure if the United States had stayed in place. And one should then add that this is a chain reaction. Because America pulled back, Britain pulled back too. Britain's commitment to France was conditional on America's commitment to Britain. Why did it have to be? Because Britain's only weapon was the blockade. That's its most powerful weapon. And the blockade is dangerous for Britain if it doesn't have the cooperation of the Americans, because it's what leads to the alienation between Washington and London in the course of 1915 and 1916. British power is a smothering naval blockade which can only be implemented alongside the Americans. If the Americans won't cooperate, then it's not safe for Britain to commit to France. And so Britain pulls back too. And that leaves France in a position where it can only seek security by means of aggression towards Germany. Which is the fundamental driver. Why does America pull back? You could adduce the politics, the extreme partisanship. One can make a case, I think, for this as a moment in the long, troubled history of American partisanship, of an extreme... it's the moment where the Democrats are associated with Bolshevism for the first time, where you get an association between the Democratic Party and leftism, that it's extremely dangerous for American political DNA from that moment onwards. I would adduce structural causes as well that need to be part of the consideration here. The American state is just not ready to bear the weight of global hegemony. And what is the fundamental indicator of this? It's the tax base. It's the fiscal apparatus. The key issue in the negotiations with the Allies and the Germans and the Americans after World War I, or at least the fundamental one that burns most slowly and most agonizedly, is reparations. British and French demands for reparations from the Germans are conditioned by the claims for dollar repayment being made by America. America cannot forgive the inter-allied debt, so-called, easily after World War I, because they constitute fully one-third of the total debts of the United States. So in modern terms, it would be a matter of trillions of dollars that the Britain and France owe to the United States. This is a pre-big government, American federal government. It's not the government of 1945-46, where in the hugely inflated apparatus of New Deal America, you can hide the Marshall Plan as a relatively small element of American government expenditure. In 1919, it's front and center And America, furthermore, has financed the war by massively progressive taxation. Rich Americans were paying extraordinarily high tax rates in 1918, 1919. So the Republican backlash is a political backlash against Wilson. It's also a political economic backlash saying this kind of craziness has got to end. 10 years ago, income tax was unconstitutional in the United States. Now I'm paying a marginal tax rate of 65 to 70%. This has got to end. And Mellon's program and the Republican administration is indicative of where that's going to go. A scaling back of government, a scaling back of tax, and all of that makes it extraordinarily difficult for America to do the deals that the big government, the New Deal apparatus of the post-45 period, can do with such extraordinary finesse after World War II.
Thanks. Bob, why don't you...
I mean, that the war debt issue is a critical issue, and it's a couple of things just to add to Adam's story. One is... When the United States began lending this money as a government, as opposed to it had been private Americans had been lending huge quantities of money before the United States entered the war. But as soon as the United States entered the war, Congress passes, I think, a $3 billion loan to the Allies. And the on the floor of Congress, the people who are arguing for this loan are saying this is a substitute, effectively, for American troops. Yes. This will help them fight for us. And there are even congressmen saying, and we don't even care if we ever get paid back, mm-hmm. because what this is doing is it's making it unnecessary for American boys to die overseas, so let the Europeans die, we'll loan them the money to fight the war. Well, needless to say, when the war is over, that's no longer operative, and Americans are just saying... the only thing I want to...
is operative in the minds of the Europeans.
No, it's...
Because they can do that math, too.
Right.
It's like, my son died.
And they do
Why
do
should
that.
I pay taxes to
they
pay
do
you
do
back?
They do that. And as you know, the French many times say, you know, we paid in blood, yeah. So you can afford to pay in dollars.
Uncle Shylock.
And now, it's also true that... I don't think you mean to, but I don't want to leave the impression that Americans had no choice about this. Republican policymakers, who then were in charge, chose not to make certain kind of sacrifices. They didn't want to run a big budget deficit because they were witnessing budget deficits that they'd never seen before. And they did want to lower taxes and do all those other things that were typically. And by the way, they wanted to raise tariffs because that was the traditional Republican policy, which also made it harder for the Europeans to earn the dollars necessary to pay back the war debts. I mean, they did everything they possibly could to make this impossible. But the major financial institutions of the time and the major bankers of the time, J.P. Morgan, was saying, you've got to forgive the debt. Otherwise, you're going to choke off the international economic system. You know this stuff much better than I do. But most of the people, as far as I know, who were actually in the banking community wanted to at least... postpone payment of the debt.
I would absolutely not deny the importance of choice, but you have to imagine the choices as constrained as the choices are in the American political system today. America is a system built on checks and balances. It's built on a system of federal representation of local interests. It's an extremely divided entity, both in partisan terms and in terms of its political economy. The interests of Wall Street are not the same as those of middle America. So the question of the ability of America to govern and to act as a hegemon depends on American political forces developing a package that works at several different levels at once. Right? This is the thing. Can you break the logjam in several different places at once? Otherwise, the American system is going to be haphazard. You'll be lucky sometimes, but the rest of the time it's a recipe for incoherence. And what you do have to credit Wilson with in his so-called New Freedom Agenda devised by Brandeis before 1914, is a kind of New Deal vision light. But it was coming out of the convulsions of the post-Reconstruction period, of the crisis of the 1890s, the extraordinary upsurge of the first populism in the American Democratic Party with William Jennings Bryan running very close in the presidency of 1896, who would have taken America out of the gold standard. And what the Democratic Party is trying to put together is an agenda that would combine increased taxation at home, reduced tariffs, a rebalancing of the political economy of America. The struggle in 1916 and about keeping America out of the war is a struggle over whether or not the White House or J.P. Morgan controls American politics.
Sure.
Because it wasn't just ordinary Americans who lent money to the European combatants. It was J.P. Morgan, which was the dominant force in Wall Street at the time, out of whose offices European war contracts were being organized in 1916, greater than the total exports of the United States in 1913. So that one private corporation, with the British Empire, the French Empire, and the Russian Empire acting from the other side, was doing a kind of public-private partnership to mobilize the United States economy against the wishes of the White House. And the Fed emerges precisely out of this struggle in the United States, going back to the 1890s, who actually controls the money power in America. All of these kind of issues are at play. The first thing that Wilson does after he's re-elected in November 1916 is to get the Fed to issue a memo to Wall Street saying, we no longer approve of issuing new private loans to the Entente, which would have strangled Britain and France but for the German decision to go for U-boats. The point I'm trying to make is, yes, there is agency at an individual level, but given the complexity of America's political economy, it takes a movement. It takes a coherent package, like the Reagan market agenda, which moves lots of different pieces of the pie simultaneously. It's an electoral strategy, it's a regulatory strategy, it's a macroeconomic strategy, it's a grand strategy in terms of defence. And so, the New Deal Bob, has that.
So no, I feel like I could just let you two argue it out, but I do want to press
one
you
final
both.
Thing,
okay, okay, and then I want to press you both on one thing.
Okay.
But why don't
you... Because I think this is... I actually think this is an interesting question, because the thing that historians always have to weigh is how much of something is structural and how much of it are decisions that actual people make. And of course, the answer is it's always both. And so I don't think there's any question that the difficulties you're talking about existed, and by the way, exist again. And I think it's likely that the aberration was the period when these problems were overcome.
That's what I was building towards. The New Deal is the aberration.
And not just the New Deal, but the whole post-World War II American approach to the world could be something that we're generally incapable of, but we did at that time. But I also just want to say, if the Senate had approved the treaty and entry into the League, which it could have, it really was Lodge's decision whether that was going to happen or not, and he decided it was in Republican political interest not to. The question is, if it had approved that, would some of these things have been easier to grease and make possible? Because you are talking about an environment where the United States had basically said, we are out, which then, of course, allows some of these forces to play, to run free.
So can I just... sorry to play the role of moderator, but that is my role.
We should play the role of discussant.
I think I should just step out and you two can just have at it, which would be great. But both of you basically... here and in your writings, argued that the U.S. could have played this World War II role potentially after World War I, and that was a big mistake. But after World War II, the United States did have this broader role of leadership. And what's interesting to me is that in 1945 and 46, it completely fell flat, right? So the United States was thinking about providing an interest-bearing loan to the UK in the winter of 1945. It was immensely unpopular in Congress. There was huge opposition. In 1946, the US wanted to play this larger role in Europe. There was enormous opposition. There was great demands to come home. I think Avril Harman said, Americans just want to come home and drink Coke and don't want to do anything in the rest of the world. And what changed was the role of communism, and it was the threat of the Soviet Union, and that's what greased the wheels of the Marshall Plan and the loan to the UK and troop deployments around the world. And so my question is, yes, structural factors, New Deal, state capacity are all facilitating, contributing factors. But Bob, you've written in The Jungle Grows Back that this American-led order is sort of an unnatural position for any country to play, and that it's an aberration and that we shouldn't really expect it. And so I guess my question to both of you is it unreasonable, should we be surprised at all about the U.S. role after World War I, because there was no overarching threat? There was no state. Yes, there was a threat of disorder and of chaos and needing to build a better world. That's always there. But there was no existential threat. And in the absence of that, and I guess that's sort of the pivot to today as well, will the U.S. just act like any other normal country and look out for its own interests and have a more minimalist approach on the world? But Adam, why don't you start and then Bob?
Well, I do agree that we need a new benchmark against which to judge what is normal, right? That's the basic question here. And history may not be a terribly good guide because it's so extreme. Like, we've had extraordinary wild oscillations. As somebody interested in the economy, I tend to come back to that as one of my organizing ideas. And that really tells you that despite the political retreat from Europe that we saw in 1919, 1920, the problem of interconnection just doesn't go away. Because, on the contrary, American money floods into Europe in the 1920s. There is a profound interconnection also for American commodity exports at the time, because that is what America exports through the 1950s, depend on those large European and those rich European markets. And that surely is the question also in the present day. You know, what is the level of interconnectedness? What is the level of systemic interconnectedness that to some extent necessitates action by the United States in its well-understood and you know, widely understood self-interest, in the sense of its an enlightened conception of American self-interest. And I think there we have to conclude, surely, that the levels of communication, the levels of economic interconnection are simply so large that a comprehensive retreat, a kind of island America kind of conception, is naive. It was naive in the 1920s. It was naive. It would have been naive after 1945, and it would be wholly so today. I mean, no economy, no group, and this is a highly unequal story, so we should be explicit. American business, we should be quite clear about this. American business and the Americans fortunate enough to have a share of its profits and wealth have benefited enormously from globalization. There is no question at all that they are the big winners, certainly not the Europeans. And so the measure of how far America needs to go needs to be, I think, benchmarks against that. One can raise the security issue too. One can raise broader issues of political ideology and how extensive and universal the claims of liberalism necessarily need to be. Can we tolerate certain sorts of abuse around the world, given our own commitments? But just from a strictly functional point of view, the economy would tell you that this is a graph, an ascending graph, an ascending line of interconnection, which particularly in its immediate region, with regard to NAFTA, for instance, but also across the Atlantic and into large parts of East Asia, now give America truly an existential interest in some kind of stabilizing role. And that I think, is where, to me, the argument needs to start. What is our benchmark, and how do we avoid the conclusion from the economic side that the interdependency is massive?
Bob?
Well, just again, I don't, you know, if you, again, look at the historical record after World War I. I think that all Americans in positions of responsibility agreed what America wanted in Europe after World War I, from Wilson to Charles Evans Hughes and Herbert Hoover. They all knew that what they wanted was a stable Germany that could become a good market for the United States again. This was certainly in Britain's interest, and sort of the revival of the European economy, which depended on preventing, on the one hand, Bolshevik revolution, and on the other hand, a return to the kind of right-wing conservatism of the past, that was in their interest. And you could read any number of documents where they make it clear that they understand perfectly well what their interests are. However, in order to fulfill those interests, they would have to do things that they were essentially forbidden by Congress from doing. And that leads, for instance, to, you know, instead of stopping the French, for instance, from invading the Ruhr to punish the Germans for not paying reparations, which we could have done, that we were taking a neutral stance on that. I would say the Ruhr invasion in 1923 was probably, was at the beginning of the end of German democracy. It certainly sowed the seeds for the unraveling of German democracy and ultimately gave a big boost to the right-wing forces. And America's failure to do that because there were certain things we would not do, even though we knew what our interests were. And so that's what concerns me now. We can perfectly well understand what an interest we have in a globalized world, but if it requires us to do the things that we've already told ourselves we're not going to do, and that could be as much as, you know, preventing an intervention somewhere, or it could simply mean caring about what's going on in Europe, because we didn't want to do that either in the 1920s. You can have a big mismatch between what your obvious interests and acknowledged interests are and what you're willing to do to preserve them.
So that's a good pivot, I think, to the present day. And Adam, in your book, in the two books, Deluge and Crash, one of the things that sort of is a common theme in both, which is sort of interesting, is you posit that if you looked at the world in 2012 or 2013, one would think that the effects of the financial crisis were very limited, right? That the populist wave had been overcome. Obama had been reelected. The bailouts had gone through. Recovery had started. And in Deluge, you sort of say the same point in 1928. You know, that in 1928, Hitler looked at the U.S. and the world and was despairing. Trotsky, I think it's the other, you have Trotsky, Churchill, and Hitler as three people who look at the world and are very optimistic. Churchill basically thinks...
They all agree on one thing, that America dominates.
Yeah, Churchill is optimistic about America, and the other two are pessimistic, but optimistic about America, right? They think the U.S.
horrified
by American power, but believing that it's sort of working out. And one of the things you say is that, you know, everything sort of depends on what comes next, right? And things can get better and then they can get worse, with that same effect. And so we're sort of seeing that obviously, you know, play out a little bit today. And part of it's in the United States, but part of it is also what's happening in China and Russia. And one could possibly say that those countries are looking at the U.S. not as a country in decline, but as a country with looming potential, you know, that they worry about what America will mean. And so my question to both of you is, you know, how worried should we be today by the deterioration in the geopolitical situation? And what are the historical parallels or that we could draw? And what are the range of futures that we're potentially facing in terms of a best case and worst case scenario? Bob, do you want to start on this one?
Well, I don't know, in a way Adam should start, because I mean, we had a conversation this morning in which you said something which I should understand but didn't understand as well until I heard you say it, which is that the growth of the Chinese economy is something that's brand new in the world. It's unprecedented in terms of its scope and its impact on the rest of the globe. I suppose you could say maybe the growth of the American economy was similar.
Absolutely.
From the late 19th century on, which did, by the way, change the whole structure of the world. And because otherwise I would say, look, there's a Russia, there's a Germany, there's a Europe, there's a, you know, if China is now where Japan was, you know, a lot of the situations are familiar, and therefore you can go back and find the appropriate historical analogy. I mean, if you look at what happens, you know, if you take things beyond 1928, well, yeah, you have the Great Depression, but if you'd had the Great Depression and a stable geopolitical environment, you might have been able to work through the Great Depression. But what really is happening, and this is where I think, you know, at some point economics gives way to force as the determining factor of history. You know, it's when the Japanese invade Manchuria in 1931 and the world proves it won't do anything about that, which I think encourages, you know, Mussolini in 1935, which I think encourages, et cetera, et cetera. And you have this cascading. You've moved from an unstable economic system to an unstable geopolitical system.
And then economics catches back up with total mobilization in the war. And the Soviet Union and the United States decide the outcome with their factories.
Exactly. But you could also say, you know, then, of course, you have a geopolitical situation which is unraveling at the same time that you have a global economic meltdown, you know. And so, but I just, to me, I'm constantly, unfortunately, worrying about the next, you know, the next shoe to fall. And the next shoe to fall is not an economic shoe. It's a geopolitical shoe. Whether it's something that the Chinese do in East Asia, whether it's something that the Russians do along their borders, or whether it's something that we're not even thinking about yet, India, Pakistan. I mean, who knows what it is? Which then begins the sort of grand unraveling. So that's the way I tend to look at it. But the thing I don't factor into that, which you do, is this utterly new phenomenon of the Chinese economic
thing. Yeah. I mean, and reading your book this morning, I big plug, you should all get it and read it, it's great. And what I particularly love about it is the way in which you insist that international order is a contingent product of peculiar historical circumstances. So a key condition for the rise of British power in the 19th century was the debilitation of all of the classic gunpowder empires of Eurasia. A key element of that is the decline of the Indian empires, the Mughal Empire, and the weakness of China at the time. And this is a precondition for the emergence of Britain, this tiny little island, which had, you know, prior to that, not really figured anywhere except in the Shakespearean imagination of the centre of the world. Like, suddenly emerges as this dominant power. And that, in turn, then opens the door and sets the stage for the United States, which also operates in that space on the basis of a British power. And, you know, on the anniversary, on the Armistice Day of 1921, the Republican administration welcomes the world to Washington for the first time for the Grand Naval Conference, which will define that new order. And it establishes the parity of 5-5, 3.5, 1.5, 1.5 for the navies of the United States, Britain, Japan, Italy, and France. And that is the new order that is taking shape, nested within the British order. So I do think, thinking about our present moment, a central element of our thinking has got to be an awareness that that 18th century ellipse, the ellipse that opened in the 18th century with the decline of China and India, anachronistic terms, at least as far as India is concerned, but the decline of the great Asian powers, that ellipse is now closing. We are no longer in that space. And so the question of power hegemony has to be posed against that backdrop. And in diagnosing it, I would go back to what I was trying to sketch earlier on, which is that the question of American power is the question of the articulation of its different elements. Because America has enormous potency at lots of different levels. At the political cultural level, despite it all, it's an attractive political culture at its best. It has enormous military heft. Undisputedly. It has huge economic power still, and the dollar remains utterly pervasive in international finance. The question at the current moment is how those different bits are articulated with each other, either in the United States itself or in relation to the key fault lines and the key crisis areas of the world. I see absolutely nothing like the kind of coherent synthesis that we saw from Wilson, or even the 1920s Republicans, which, God bless them, had a disarmament, private finance kind of model, or the New Deal, or the Reagan-era model of American power. Nothing of the sort appears to exist currently in this town. And without that, the way in which those vectors of power operate and then intersect with the massively complex regional tensions of East Asia is hugely unpredictable. And it's not clear whether the American political system at this moment has the capacity to resynthesize something like a coherent foreign policy vision.
Can you unpack that a little bit? I mean, there is a view, right? There is an idea, which is the traditional post-war idea of prolonging, preserving the status quo, the alliance system in Asia, in Europe, you know, encouraging China's rise as long as it's not aggressive or assertive in foreign policy. There's a little bit of rethinking of that now on the economic side. But it's not, I think, you know, there may not be alternatives, but there is a very clear sort of American view of international order. So I guess my question is, you know, with this unprecedented rise of China, what are you suggesting that sort of an accommodation should take place, that the U.S. should sit down with China and try to sort of figure out a way to ensure that it's satisfied, or, as you sort of suggested in Deluge, that the U.S. should basically stand up for this multilateral order and do what Bob suggested and push back again against any instances of aggression for fear of setting a precedent?
I mean, the novelty of the situation, I think, can be kind of indexed by four elements of our current political economy. I mean, we have a situation, this is not a 1970s or 80s Cold War situation where we can re-clarify the fronts and just raise military spending, because the United States business community has a giant stake in China. GM sells more cars in China than it does in anywhere in the United States. Apple doesn't have an alternative to the production of iPhones in China right now. It isn't Samsung, which actually has a Vietnam base. At the same time, Chinese business is hugely indebted, you might be surprised to hear, in dollars. We think that the Chinese business community on the private side has a $2 trillion exposure. So there is huge entanglement in a way that we've never had before. Add to that the fundamental questions, if you like, of the technological frontier and the question of data and artificial intelligence and the resources that democratic law-constrained regimes on the one hand, be they of the American or the European variant, which are themselves quite different, and the unfettered authoritarianism of China offers for the development of data-driven new frontier technologies. in which, again, America so far has demanded and claimed for itself a preeminent role, and yet now faces the reality that there is a genuine competitor in China, and the fact that China accounts currently for 30% of world growth, more than the United States, Europe, and India combined. And then, superimposed on top of that, our simple model of deciding that we may need to sort of front up against China and raise geopolitical tension. That configuration, in that form, on those dimensions, in that scale, we have never seen before. And this isn't even before. We haven't even invoked the nightmare of the early 2000s, which was the fact that America's fiscal incontinence, the fact that its books don't balance, in part because of large-scale military expenditure, means it is structurally dependent on various types of external financing. And the question of where that's going to come from down the line is quite open at this point. That it's, emerging markets have not been big buyers of US treasuries for several years now. Where and whether that is a stable configuration going forward is just very unclear. So that's what I mean by saying that the bits are disarticulated. We have a technological frontier which is intersecting and indelibly connected with politics. We can't get away from the fact that artificial intelligence and tech involve issues of civil liberties. We have crass commercial interests running one way, we have crass commercial interests running the other way, and we have a fundamentally unresolved fiscal situation in the United States driven by intractable domestic political economy, constantly compounded by rising inequality in the United States, which perpetuates itself in this unbalanced fiscal situation. That configuration, with that degree of entanglement, is historically novel, especially if it attaches, you know, and we're not talking about Imperial Germany and Edwardian Britain. These are orders of magnitude larger lumps that we're talking about here. China and the United States are much, much bigger parts of an even bigger and more complex system. That's the lack of synthesis I'm referring to.
But it seems to me there are two ways to try to rationalize these things into a coherent policy, yeah. And we've done both and neither,
yeah.
Basically.
Currently, we're in neither.
But you know, one is to say, well, and as people like, you know, Bob Blackwell and Ashley Tellis and others have recommended, is we have to get our economic strategy in line with our geopolitical, yeah, strategy, which means we have to, you know, basically stop feeding the Chinese beast in whatever way we can, and the sort of version of that we're getting is tough trade, you know, tough trade talks, trying to deal with intellectual property and all the things the Chinese are doing that are taking advantage of the system, while at the same time beefing up your military. So to me, that's like trying to move toward a Cold War situation. I think that's impossible. I personally think that's impossible. I think that because we're a capitalist country, and because of everything you say about business, we're never going to be able to sustain that politically.
That's the 1916 right. Moment. That's like Wilson trying to kill J.P. Morgan's entente business.
Well, right, and that didn't work, by the way. It wasn't going to work, and you know, this is like Jefferson understood immediately. He wanted to embargo the whole rest of the world, but he knew that they couldn't do it because the Americans were. So, it seems to me the other way of rationalizing this is, you know, aside from negotiating with the Chinese about whether they're cheating too much on one thing or another, not engaging in an effort to squeeze their economic capacity, letting their economic capacity go where it's going to go, and having this mutual economic, you know, dependency, but then being strong enough militarily to continually steer them in the direction of economic growth rather than geopolitical growth. Now, you say that we can't afford to do that. I actually think that our fiscal problem is not based on our military expenditure, big as that is. It's obviously based on other things like entitlement spending that we refuse to deal with, and other budget items. But it seems to me that deterring them militarily and allowing them to succeed economically is our best hope of rationalizing the situation. I do think that the Chinese, when confronted on the one hand by a credible military deterrent and on the other hand by this incredible mutual economic interdependence, which means for us it means you might lose an election, for them it means they might lose their lives if things implode, that between those two things, that is enough to sort of contain this problem at least for the foreseeable future.
So let's take a step back toward Europe for a second, and then we'll go to questions in the audience in 5 or 10 minutes or so. But looking at Europe today, right, I think both of you are relatively pessimistic about where Europe is headed, and it is a an interesting sort of example of the retrenchment of American power, not necessarily militarily, because even the Trump administration has bolstered U.S. forces in Central and Eastern Europe, but politically and diplomatically. You know, the U.S. is deeply engaged in Europe after World War II and then throughout the 70 years since, but has essentially, you know, washed its hands of it, of the internal European debates. The U.S. is nowhere to be seen on Brexit at all, completely absent from any attempt to shape the negotiations. We see Germany, looking at its post-Merkel future, authoritarian developments in Central and Eastern Europe. And so how should we think about sort of the, and Adam, in your work in particular, you talk about the centrality of the Atlantic economy still in the global economy, and that on financial power and the financial crisis and the possibility of recurrence, that it's still really Europe that is the most sort of worrisome variable there. Above everywhere else. So how should we think about Europe's future? What are the, can we conceive of, you know, alternative futures to the EU and the Eurozone? I mean, if Merkel and Macron essentially fail to, in their attempt to build a closer union, what type of Europe are we facing? And maybe, Adam, we could start with you and then go to Bob.
What I argue in the book, and it's an important point, I think, is that the reality of transatlantic financial diplomacy from 2008-2009 onwards is an unwritten story. It really doesn't do justice to either the late Bush administration or the Obama administration to say that they washed their hands of the Eurozone crisis. The real question we have to ask is why their extremely active engagement with the financial crisis and then the Eurozone crisis in Europe was on the down low in the way that it was, why it was buried as deep as it was, why it features nowhere in the retrospective accounts of Obama-era foreign policy that have poured off the presses since. It's an extraordinary fact, I think, that when, you know, Obama gave that Atlantic interview that was the sort of starting gun for the retrospectives on the Obama administration, Europe barely figures, other than for him to say, well, you know, he wished they'd pull their socks up and do a little bit more. The reality is that America was knee-deep in the inside struggle over the effort to stabilize the financial crisis in 2008 in Europe, and then the Eurozone crisis that followed. And it had to be, because, as I, you know, insistently arguing, the stakes are simply too high. Half the funds held by one of the largest classes of money market mutual funds in the United States were invested in European bond stock. The one thing that could have jeopardized the fragile American recovery in 2011 would have been the failure of one or several major European banks. At the key moments, and the G20 provided an absolutely crucial cover for this, these meetings of the G20, which are notionally global, but they break out into groups, and at key moments, the G20 would focus on Eurozone problems in Mexico, where it was meeting, or in France, where it was meeting. And at the absolutely critical moments, the French handed the chairmanship of G20 meetings pertaining to the Eurozone to the Americans. Why? Because Obama was the only person that could muscle Merkel into line in shifting her position on the Eurozone. America continued to play throughout that crisis the pivotal role. And I don't need to speak about Ukraine sitting next to you, Bob. The tacit interaction between Berlin and Washington over the handling of the Ukraine crisis is pivotal to the entire story in Eastern Europe. Of course, it's not a story without frustrations, but it's a story of continued, essential interdependence, which offloads problems the Americans don't really need to be dealing with and translates them to a zone where they really should be dealt with. And then, of course, the Europeans do tend to fail. So I am pessimistic. But to me, this is a self-fulfilling prophecy. If America and Europe continue basically to hide the scale of their interdependence and not to celebrate the win that the joint management of the financial crisis between 2008 and 12 ultimately proved to be, then liberals shouldn't be, you know, surprised if their enemies point essentially to the continuous failure of their model to provide what, you know, average Europeans and Americans desperately want, which is shared prosperity for everyone. But I don't want to go into too much of the financial details, but without the swap lines which the Fed provided to the European banks, which is basically a shower of dollar liquidity onto the other side of the Atlantic, none of the European banks would have survived. And yet this was essentially written out of history by the Europeans and the Americans after 2008. That, I think, is the question we have to ask. It's similar to me to the structurally analogous to the NSA scandal. I mean, why is that a scandal? Everyone in Europe must have understood that their security agencies were in bed with the NSA, apart from anything else, because they transparently don't have the capacities that the Americans do have and which the Europeans rely on in that area as they rely on the United States in so many other areas. And this was the unfolding crisis in Europe. First of all, the shock horror probe, the Snowden revelations, then the revelations about the bugging of Merkel's phone, and then the dawning realization that the German security service was completely in bed with the NSA and the American intelligence, and had to be, because it really doesn't have that many capacities. It's quite good at human intel, but it doesn't have any of the technological resources to do it itself. Now, one can argue from different political points of view what kind of a surveillance apparatus we want to have and what our relationships ought to be. But the extraordinary thing about our present moment in that area, as in finance, is that we seem determined to avoid the conversation. And what worries me about that is it's a de facto offloading of what are fundamentally political, geoeconomic, geopolitical questions, which ought to be the subject of basic bargains. You were referring early on to communism. Legitimate it however we're going to legitimate them. Make them palatable to a broader public however we need to make them palatable, or however palatable we can, you know, reasonably make them palatable. It's not just the manipulative question. We actually have to build some conviction around our answers. And those hard political tasks are being dodged over and over again in the transatlantic sphere. And we end up with these bizarre conversations about, you know, the prospective major trade deal between Europe and the United States being boiled down by European progressives to the question of chlorine chickens. This becomes the key issue, whilst the Europeans are blind to the fact that the Americans won't touch the European banking system with a barge pole because they think it's so badly regulated. So the politics of TTIP in Europe was a politics of chlorine-clean chickens rather than the stability of the European financial system. I mean, that is an abdication of political responsibility. Either we're for it or against it. Make the case one way or the other, but talk about the actual pillars of power and interconnection here, not that kind of peripheral irrelevance.
Bob? What's your view of chlorinated chicken?
I was, in terms of keeping the economic relationship on the down low, I mean, I just can't help remembering that in the 1920s, when the United States wanted to negotiate what became known as the Dawes Plan, American officials traveled to Britain, because they pretended this was all being done by private entities. American officials traveling to London to have these negotiations behind the scenes had to pretend that they were visiting their tailors.
Or the Bar Association.
Oh, right.
They hosted the annual meeting of the American Bar Association in London so that Charles Hughes could go.
Who was then Secretary of State, but he was not going as Secretary of State. He was going as a member of the Bar Association. Yeah. So, I mean, there's a long history here. And again, it is worth remembering that if we're talking about what the norm is the United States and Europe do not get along. And I think it's worth remembering how unusual it is historically for us to be as tightly intertwined as we were. Nevertheless, I think you can make the case on Ukraine it happened because of Russia. But when it came to internal European politics, when Germany was reunifying, the Americans, the George H.W. Bush administration, believed that this was a vital interest of the United States, that this thing work out correctly, and they were heavily involved in making Margaret Thatcher feel better, in making Mitterrand feel better about what was happening. It wasn't that the Germans weren't going to do it anyway, but the Americans felt they had to shepherd it along. When Brexit begins, and when Brexit is when we're still going through the divorce, which is at least as important from the American strategic point of view, Britain separated from Europe is a disaster for the United States in terms of our interest in a coherent Europe. And we did almost nothing to prevent it. Are you going to, or you don't think it's a disaster?
No, it's a total disaster. Obama went to London.
That was so late in the day. You can't go swimming into London and say, by the way, you should really vote against Brexit. I mean, there had to be a whole process. By the way, I'm not even saying we could prevent it.
The U.S. has been absent since on the negotiations.
That's what I would more say. It was maybe Brexit was going to happen in the same way the German reunification was going to happen, because, by the way, Britain distancing itself from the continent is also the most normal activity in the history of the world. However, the way this divorce played out, the United States has an interest in the way it plays out. And we have not been playing that game in the same way that we did shepherd German unification through.
No, the day after it happened, Trump was on his golf course in Scotland cheering.
No, I know.
The current administration of the United States favors Brexit, and to the alarm of the Europeans, and these are the stories that are followed in Europe, the day after he entered the White House, he's like taking bets on which country leaves
and
next.
And by the way, this is what's new. Even in the 1920s, when Americans were not doing anything to save Europe, they would have liked to save Europe.
Yeah, they were not in the hostility.
Trump is on the side of Brexit. He's on the side of Le Pen. He's on the side of Salvini. He's on the side of Viktor Orban. He's on the side of all the people who were against a coherent liberal Europe. And that is absolutely unprecedented.
And he's not, I mean, alone. I mean, John Bolton wrote a series of op-eds for the New York Post in 2010, 11, 12, in which he called for, he said America had an interest in the collapse of the Eurozone. So at a point when the U.S. is deeply involved in trying to bolster the Eurozone, he's saying, you know, the euro is a threat to American interests. So it
but
is.
But this is the same. This is exactly the same thing that was said when the League of Nations was actually an imperial effort to, to take over the United States and deprive us of our sovereignty. I mean, we're back to William Borah type arguments.
So let's go to the audience. So we'll take a few questions. So the gentleman over here, to start with.
Both of you gentlemen seem to insinuate that Henry Cabot Lodge might have had the power to prevent World War II had he approved the League of Nations, or at least made it less likely.
I think I insinuated that. Let alone leave poor Adam.
No, I've got a view of the Lodge.
If we accept this as true or at least somehow persuasive, I wonder if... as being in America's interest, despite being at odds with the Republican Party's interest in the... in that period of time. The question is, can he be blamed? What changes would need to be made to see the right decision more easily? How should our elected officials today determine the appropriate time to place country above party? And is there ever a time to place party above country?
Great, thank you. So the gentleman here, yeah.
Thank you, Larry.
And if you could introduce yourself and then ask a question.
Yeah, Larry Checco, senior advisor to Serve USA. I learned a lot. I thought I knew something about this subject, but I guess I didn't. Today, with Mr. Trump doing what he's doing, I used to think that was an aberration on the part of the United States. It seems like it's just history repeating itself. We saw what happened when we withdrew from the the world in the 20s, and all you had was Europe to deal with. Now we're withdrawing, and we have China, Russia, Europe, all of that. How further can we go into this without really jeopardizing our hegemony?
Great, thank you. And then the lady just behind. Yeah, and then we'll go to...
Thank you very much. I'm Marina Fazel, an African-American journalist. You mentioned that the unpredictability of what international interactions might combust into a future crisis for the whole world, and in reference to First World War and the atmosphere of the major wars in the past. The Russians just recently hosted the Taliban. Afghanistan was pivotal in the Cold War and in the fall of it. Some Afghans like to take credit for bringing down the Soviet Union. Right now, in the midst of this atmosphere where in the Trump era, American foreign diplomacy still is undefined for internal and external audiences. Afghans wonder, like many other nations, where they should look to in terms of this evolving new world order. What could a country like Afghanistan look towards? What kind of commitment can it expect from United States and its Western allies? Thank you.
Great, thanks. So back to both of you, and then we'll go to another round in a minute.
Do you want to start the argument we're about to have about Henry Cabot Lodge?
No. I'm a revisionist. I mean, I just follow the revisionist trend on Lodge, which is to say that the historiography of, you know, so-called isolationism was written by disappointed Wilsonians. In fact, though Lodge and the Republicans opposed the treaty as Wilson proposed it, they were in fact willing to uphold the security guarantees that Wilson had made to the French.
This
and the
is where
British.
We're going to have our argument,
and because they regarded that as a much more parsimonious and more important commitment. That one of the reasons they didn't like the League was that it was essentially a kind of system of indifference. whereas the Republicans throughout the war would uphold a position which was strongly in favour of the Entente to a degree that Wilson was never comfortable with. So I actually think that if... And Wilson, in response to the Republicans attaching conditions to the peace proposal, withdrew the whole thing, never allowing Congress to have a chance to vote on the subordinate elements, which were a security guarantee for Britain and France, which are actually the essentials of a stable peace, not the League, but the security guarantee for Britain and France. So the two of them sort of stalemated each other, removing two elements of an architecture that would have been stable either individually or together, and none of them transpired. On Afghanistan, let me speak about that. I think... what surely must be exciting Afghanis, I imagine, and I don't know, but if I was Afghani, I'd be excited by it, is what's happening in Pakistan and the unfolding there of this extraordinary drama of geopolitics. Pakistan and Afghanistan are key to the stability of that entire region. The problem of Islamism, obviously, but also the problem of economic development. And what we have in Pakistan is this test case of the balance of forces between the old order, which is the IMF-centred regime, dominated by the Western powers still, though with China having an increasingly large voice, and it'll be very interesting to see how Madame Lagarde plays this out, and China, with its absolutely massive investment in the One Belt, One Road annex in Pakistan. And how that hashes out, I think, is one way of testing the contours of this new system. Because as far as I know, and I must admit that I didn't follow the political economy of the American campaign in Afghanistan to the extent that I would have liked, but it struck me even then that we were very strong on drones and finding Taliban leaders and hunting people down in the Swat Valley, but I don't remember a large-scale commitment in the tens of billions of dollar range to rural development in Pakistan, infrastructure development, the prospect of the sort of thing America routinely did in Vietnam, by the way, to very mixed reviews. But that kind of holistic thinking about social stabilization and betterment, I think, slipped further down the agenda of American policy. And it's very interesting that the Chinese, with the One Belt, One Road program, with this commitment to very big building in Asia, but also in Africa, are in the business of changing the game about how we think about the development prospects of some of the poorest societies in the world. And Pakistan is very important on that list because it's one of the poorest societies with nuclear weapons in one of the most dangerous areas. So that, I think, for me, is the thing I'd be looking for. Afghans should watch Pakistan closely and see how that story plays out there.
Bob?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when it comes to the Chinese involvement in One Belt, One Road, I must say I'm not as persuaded as everybody else is this is a horrible thing, and that if they're the ones who want to throw their money, which, by the way, may not be the best investments for them, as far as I'm sure. Some of it is being done for strategic reasons, which means, in a certain sense, it's not being done for strictly economic reasons. And so, therefore, and if it leads to some development, I don't know that I have any great objection to that. I wanted to answer your question about... you know, the one thing about this, the structure that's been set up, that was set up after World War II, this sort of alliance structure that the United States is at the center of, I do think it's extraordinarily durable, and that it will take a lot of undoing. Now, I do think we are in the process of undoing it, and I think that process began under Obama, actually, just because I think, you know, the mere fact that they have to hide what they're doing in Europe means the American public isn't really there. They know it's not really there. Obama acted as if American support wasn't there, and Trump is explicitly saying that we're not in that game anymore. And so, and you just don't know, you know, historically, a situation has been created for an explosion, but the explosion may not come for 10 years. But I do want to say that, you know, all the America's allies overseas have near neighbors that they are afraid of. They are naturally going to look to the United States for that support. And for as long as they have any hope of getting that support, they're going to keep looking there because they don't really have a lot of other options. The Baltic states don't have other options, you know. I think that Japan, its option is to become independent, become a nuclear power, become a militarized Japan again. I think most Japanese do not want to go there. So they're going to continue to look to the United States. So I think this is one of those takes where there's a lot of ruin in an international system that was created, and I don't think that one term or maybe even two terms of a Trump will necessarily undermine it. But that's contingent on events, and you just don't know what's going to come up that's going to blow things up. I think I should avoid getting into the argument about exactly the fate of the French Security Treaty was, because we could have that separate discussion. What the view that Adam is expressing is unfortunately no longer the revisionist view. It's now the mainstream view. And it's just, I'm sorry, it's just wrong. I have a book coming out in a year, and then you can
we can do this again.
And I go into excruciating and I hope not too deadly boring detail about what happened to the French Security Treaty, because I do think it's a pivotal question. Suffice to say that the first person to lay out in detail, in all its grandiose elements, the idea of a League of Nations was Theodore Roosevelt. And he did it at the end of 1914 in response to what had just happened. Henry Cabot Lodge was a big supporter of the idea of what he called the United Nations. And they were incredibly, and the latecomer to this idea was Woodrow Wilson, who really, as a Democrat, because in those days the two parties had a distinct position. The internationalists were Republicans. The Democrats were, quote-unquote, isolationists. Why Roosevelt and Lodge then flipped against the League, historians and intellectuals have been dying to say it's because they had the problem with this particular and that particular, which they had no problem with when they articulated it themselves. The truth is, in my view, it was about politics, and they hated Woodrow Wilson, which was an incredibly, for Roosevelt, by the way, he felt guilty that Wilson was in power. Yeah. You know why? Because it was his fault. He got Wilson elected, and his bitterness toward Wilson is about that sense of responsibility, and it informs so much else. Anyway, I said I wasn't going to do that, and then I did it anyway.
Can I add a micro rider? It's really important, I think, to recognize that Wilson is the first Southern president elected since the Civil War. And the most, I think, cutting abuse that Teddy Roosevelt hurls at him is that you're a copperhead. You are a surrendering Illinois Democrat who wants to rip the floor out from underneath the Lincoln presidency. The stakes in this war are the same stakes, essentially, as in the Civil War. That is the kind of test that we're undergoing here. And you, with your peace without victory talk, have literally adopted a slogan from 1864. Right.
And then it kills Roosevelt that Wilson is the one to lead them into war and win the war. Because that was supposed to be him.
And his son dies
in the war. Okay.
So we don't have that much time now to see a bunch of hands. We have 5 minutes at the end for our vice president. Well, 2 minutes at the end to give some closing remarks. So we take a lightning round to the lady here in the second row. All the questions seem to be on this side. I don't know what happened. There's one over here.
Thank you. First of all, I'm Helen Sonnenschein, a retired economist, and fascinated with all these kinds of programs. But this one was so overwhelming because there are so many pieces that is, in retrospect, different from the way we thought of it. And trying to put the pieces together and to connect it to today. My question specifically, though, is how do we deal with not just this administration, but later on when the State Department has been devastated by lack of personnel and power and so forth, and the entire government White House structure has no structure. There's no strategic plan, whether especially in foreign policy or in economic policy. Everything is just ad hoc, and I see things just tumbling down, making for even greater chaos.
Thank you. So the gentleman behind, right.
Hi, Carl Golovin, domain reference and idealliveson.net. As a reference for my question, two references. Benjamin Friedman, at age 71, gave a talk at the Willard Hotel here in D.C. in 1961. He was connected in the Wilson administration. He was actually present in Versailles in 1919. Secondly, a book, The Controversy of Zion, by journalist Douglas Reed, written in 1956, not published until 1978. You mentioned the money power circa 1900. Arguably, the money power is named in the person to whom the Balfour Declaration was addressed. And Friedman would argue that the Balfour Declaration.
So which is the question? It's
laying a foundation.
Briefly. We have very limited time, so okay. Just.
The Balfour Declaration, was it not negotiated as a reward for bringing the U.S. into the war by Zionist interests? And Reid would argue that the roots and objectives of both Bolshevism and Zionism were inextricably intertwined.
All right, I think we got it. Thanks. And so the gentleman down the back, and then the lady in the middle, and then we'll call it.
My name is Jeremiah Reamer. I used to teach at SAIS. Just two quick questions to Adam Tooze. I'm a little puzzled about the association of the Democratic Party with Bolshevism that early, given that the Palmer raids, the guy who led the Palmer raids also, ran for the Democratic nomination. And for much of the 1920s, the Klan was a major part of the Democratic Party. Yeah. That's one little question. I'm very
Isn't politics wonderful?
But my more important question goes to, I agree with you that that Obama and Geithner's role in the European euro crisis was very, very important. And I'm intrigued by and like to get further thoughts from you on why it is that isn't celebrated. Yeah. It's very interesting. I mean, I can imagine it's difficult for both sides to sort of sell this to their publics, their constituencies, their ideologies. It's hard for me to see Merkel saying, yes, of course, I had to agree with Schäuble and the austerity hawks, but really I'm grateful that Obama and Geithner and the IMF made me do solidarity with Greece, made me do more stimulus. And it must be also difficult for the Democratic Party for some reason to say, gee, we really even wanted more stimulus, but we pushed it on Europe. Yep. Something like that.
Thank you. And final question to the lady on the aisle. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm a journalist with Hong Kong Phoenix TV. My question is, right now we are right after the midterm election, and it looks very hard for Trump administration to pass any domestic legislations. So on foreign policy side, should we expect he's going to look for more breakthrough in the next 2 years? And do you expect he's going to take much tougher stance on issues like North Korea and trade with China? Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're pretty short on time, so if you could maybe just choose one or two of those and just give quick responses, and then we'll turn it over to Bruce. So Adam and then Bob.
Since it's so puzzling, I'll talk about the association between the Democrats and Bolshevism. It goes by way of the controversy caused by Wilson's negotiations with Germany over the heads of the Allies in October. What's that got to do with the Bolsheviks? It's got to do with the Bolsheviks because of Germany's role in sluicing Lenin into Russia in 1917, and more importantly and more immediately, the fact that the Germans had done the Brest-Litovsk peace treaty with the Bolsheviks earlier in the year, which is what had unleashed the full force of the German army on the Western Front in 1918 and almost brought the house down. So from the point of view of militant Republicans who want to blaze a path of fire from the Western Front to Berlin, which is really what they want to do, no negotiations, somebody who is selling the Allies out, as Wilson was perceived to be doing, to do a deal with the Germans on the basis of his peace without victory proposal of January 1917 before America was even in the war, looks like an agent of German and Bolshevik conspiracy. Very briefly, and I don't want to be misunderstood here, it's no doubt at all that in the minds of anti-Semitic British statesmen in 1917 who were trying to make sense of the world and were reading the London Times, whose reporter in Russia in 1917 was a profoundly anti-Semitic British reporter, and who attributed the influence of the world Jewish conspiracy to the undermining of Tsarism and the advent of Bolshevism. In the minds of people who have that kind of framework of analysing the world, there is indeed a connection between the influence of Jewish bankers and American policy. And there is already, on the part of British policymakers, an expectation that if you cut a deal like this by way of figures like Brandeis, you will be able to gain some kind of purchase over Washington. And it is framed quite explicitly in those terms as a bid for the opinion of world Jewry
in which, of course, Zionist activists have an interest in cultivating the idea that such a thing exists and that it does, in fact, have some influence, because by means of that idea, you can, in fact, then exercise leverage over decision makers in London and in New York and Washington. But you have to insist that those constructions, that architecture, is framed by a pre-existing anti-Semitism that starts on the basis of the existence of that. Within that context, those linkages are real, they're documented, there is no doubt at all that that is what the decision makers in London thought they were doing. We also know the work that the Zionist organizations around the world had to do to suppress protests from Jewish communities across the world against the Balfour Declaration, notably in revolutionary Russia, where an association of the largest Jewish community in the world with an imperialist promise of a Palestinian homeland at the expense of the Ottoman Empire at this particular moment would have been devastating for their revolutionary credentials. The government had just fallen in Petrograd precisely over that issue, its willingness to uphold early war commitments to imperialism against the Ottoman Empire and the Habsburg Empire. And so Zionist actors in both London and Washington have to do a huge amount of work to silence the news of the fact that huge assemblies of Russian Jews had voted against approving this. So it's a hugely complex force field in which the virus of anti-Semitic conspiracy theory is operating in an extraordinary polysemous kind of way, having meaning for lots of different actors at lots of different places.
Just add the American politics part of that, because I don't think Roosevelt and Lodge were playing that particular game. But they had decided, and it's kind of interesting given where we are at this moment, they had decided early on that that their position was going to be, we are nationalists. Yeah. We are looking out for America, and we are American nationalists, as contrasted with Wilson, who was an internationalist. And as it happens, everybody knew that what an internationalist meant was that Trotsky was also a sort of self-proclaimed internationalist, because the revolution had to be international. And so at his big speech opposing the League of Nations, Henry Cabot Lodge says, I was born in America, I'm an American, and I'm an American nationalist, and I will not support those who, like Trotsky, go the way of the Bolsheviks and internationalism. Okay, that's our Henry Cabot Lodge for you. And if you, I mean, that is just political rhetoric. I don't think he believes one tiniest bit of it, but that was the political decision they made to run on at that time. And we've seen it, I think, again.
Thank you. This is terrific. I'd like to call on our Vice President for Foreign Policy, Bruce Jones, who will offer some closing remarks and take us home. So thank you.
I'll be very brief. I wanted to thank you all for coming out on this event to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the armistice. I think it's an extremely good day to reach back into rich histories of the events that unfolded at the time and the events that have unfolded since to try to understand where we are. I've just been both in Tokyo and in Shanghai. In Tokyo, where there's lots of talk, Bob, of a return to what gets coded as war-fighting capabilities, not self-defense capabilities. And in Shanghai, where the strategy there is kind of continued financial integration as a way of defanging our capacity to constrain them, but with a lot of that beginning to unravel. And Adam, you briefly mentioned Imperial Germany and Edwardian Britain, and I wonder whether we aren't beginning to see a replay of a deliberate strategy to deintegrate the economies precisely for geopolitical reasons, leading to the kinds of concerns that Bob has. But I have to say that it's extremely refreshing to hear nuanced accounts of the interplay between economics and geopolitics rather than superficial accounts of them, which we're spending a lot of time dealing with in this town and elsewhere today. Adam, you also said that history may not be a guide to where we're going, but at the very least to have the rich history that you both do and the incredibly informed discussion we had today helps us close off some mistaken analogies and some mistaken possibilities and to focus us on what really is in front of us. So I'm incredibly grateful to you for writing your books, to Bob for being Bob, to Tom for leading this conversation, and to all of you for being here today. And thank you so much.
Yeah. This is good. I really enjoyed it.